You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey everybody, Rob here, and I've got a special feed drop for you for the patrons of Rob's Podcast. You got to hear Survivor Academy all season long, but I thought because we had a really fun episode this past week to close out the season of Survivor Academy for the patrons, I thought it might be fun to drop another great episode in the main feed. This time out, Taryn Armstrong joins me. Of course, he did the Survivor Stock Watch all season long and has been in recapping the season, but I never got the chance to talk to Taryn about Survivor since we had the draft way back in the beginning of March. So I invited Taryn to join me on the Survivor Academy, the patron-only show, where we take a look at Survivor every single week of the season and try to figure out what future players can learn from each week of Survivor. And if you're interested in more original content like this, plus the greatest reality TV community in the world, head on over to robiswebsite.com/patron to find out more about becoming a patron of Rob's Podcast. Enjoy this feed drop of Survivor Academy. Hello and welcome back, students, to another week, our final exam here at the Survivor Academy. And we are in such luck today to have one of the finest instructors that we have here in all of Survivor Academy. Please welcome in the great Taryn Armstrong. Taryn, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Very excited to put my professor hat on. And maybe like one of those pointers. I've always wanted one of those pointers.
What would you
maybe
point
I should have
to?
Got one.
A chalkboard?
Does it matter? Mm-hmm. Just anything. Just like,
yeah.
Just whip it around.
Have you ever thought about having like, the whiteboard, to be able to go to in any of the, you know, whether it's the live feed update or, stock watch or, you know, Survivor recaps?
No, because I hate writing. Like physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hate drawing physically. I hate drawing computerally also, but mm-hmm.
you hate drawing.
Just in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Who likes drawing? People that are good at it.
Kids. Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah. Yeah. But that being said, it's so nice to have you here to talk about Survivor 42 and take one last look back at things from the finale and just sort of a general note of what do the future players need to take away from Survivor 42. And it's been a very fun series that we've gotten to do along the way. So I'm glad we have a chance to sort of look back and talk about everything. Taryn, how have you been?
I've been doing well. The Big Brother season ended, Survivor ended, The Circle ended, and now we've got a couple of weeks here before things start to kick off again.
Yeah, some downtime for you. What do you do to fill this downtime?
Mostly just got back to work on other things, like the streaming on Twitch, putting together some videos from the Among Us games that we've been playing weekly for the last couple of years. I want to start releasing those on YouTube. Going back to the start. So I've been working on those and some other stuff. Just, you know, I don't sit still very well.
Okay. Overall, Taryn, you had to have been happy with Survivor 42, right?
Oh yeah.
Even though you didn't win a draft this time.
Yes. Maybe it came close. Mm-hmm. Maybe. If you're going to lose, you want to lose to somebody like Marianne.
Yeah.
like that's a good way to lose.
So, big picture, how much do you think that Survivor 42 will be a season that we look back and feel like it was a season that changed the show?
That changed the show. I think it's going to be hard to separate 42 from 41. Mm-hmm. I think that they both played out so similarly in structure and in the way that the overall meta of the strategy was implemented. In terms of something that is a part of a larger trend, but I think is more exaggerated in these more recent seasons, which is, you know, the highest head that pokes out of the crowd gets chopped off. And then one after another, that's just how it goes. I think that's kind of the strategy of the moment. And I think that this is another representation of that with Marianne being a good example of how to win in that environment.
Okay, well, let's start to bring in Marianne's win, because obviously we did not know that she was going to be the winner from the last time that we got to talk about looking back at the season. And one of the great things that she did was the final tribal council. Candace asked us, what are some key points you want to mention and things to leave out in your final jury speech? Could you get away with exaggerating the role you played in the game? I just thought that Marianne conducted a clinic at the final tribal council of how to do the final tribal council correctly.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's sort of one of the examples of, I think, how Marianne was able to win in this environment, which is that there seems to be this idea in the players' heads at this point in time, which is, we need a resume. We need big moves. And that's something that people have talked about for a while, the big moves era and all of that. And that is important because that is how the jury does look at the players. And they do want to award the biggest, best player. But you can't ignore the social aspect of it. Of course, this is a tale as old as time at this point. But more specifically in this era of Survivor, not only the social aspect of it, but how that impacts the final jury, final tribal situation, where you're being questioned by the jury. And unlike a show like Big Brother, where you have approximately 2 minutes to explain your game, in Survivor, you have a lot of time to really explain your game, to interact with the jury, to interact with the people sitting next to you, and really make a case, really use the social bonds that you've created, the persona that you have, to craft a narrative for the game that you've played and why the people should vote for you. And that's where Marianne did a really good job using her likability, the relationships that she had built, and then putting just enough action of like, this is what I did. Just enough of a story about how she was strategically very sound, along with some passion, and it was everything she needed.
Yeah, I think that you bring up a lot of good points there. The idea of the resume, I think, it's definitely out there as an idea. I think that the resume is more of like, I don't know the exact way I would describe it, but it's almost like that you have to have like at least like a minimum of like certain criteria met to be able to, just like, the mission was accomplished of I did things like I did enough things that it's justifiable to say, you know, I made moves in the game, where if you have absolutely nothing, I don't know how, if people are going to ever vote for you. But I do think that likability part that you mentioned is, I think maybe
even is the most important part of this final tribal presentation. And in this, like, you know, final tribal council format, you do have a chance to sort of like interact with the jury one last time and really remind people you like me, you know, come on.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm likable.
And yeah. And use that likability to gain their respect, right? You know, get them to appreciate your game. And that's where I think some players in the modern era of Survivor are maybe getting a little bit ahead of themselves, where they feel like, okay, you know, for example, like Omer needs to go because nobody would ever be able to beat Omer, or Lindsay needs to go because nobody will ever be able to beat Lindsay. I think it's okay to also think about, okay, what if that's really dangerous for me? What if by taking out Omer or Lindsay or maybe High before them, like I become the big threat and now I'm in trouble. It's going to be harder for me to get to the end. You need to be able to at least consider the option of, okay, what about the route where I keep the big threat in the game, but I work overtime on making sure that I beat them in the end. I start thinking about my arguments against them right now. I start planting seeds in people, not to get them out, but to discredit them when it comes to the mm-hmm. jury phase, the final tribal, to get people to not like them as much or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
I think people underestimate that there's game to be played there that I feel like we don't often see, you know, on screen, but can be very effective.
Yeah. And I feel like that, you know, we've seen this a little bit more in Big Brother, and please, like, nobody take this as like a one for one. But, you know, when we think back to, you know, Josh and Paul in Big Brother 19, where, you know, and Josh kind of like emerged at the end, you know, he won a challenge or two, but he went down to the end with Paul, but had been planting some seeds about like, you know, to get people to know that, you know, it was Paul that was like betraying them and was, you know, a likable enough person in the end who ultimately got the votes. I don't think that Mike dominated the game in anywhere near the way that Paul did in that season. And I think Marianne had more going on throughout the course of the game than Josh did at times. But like, I think it's a similar story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that that's like when we think about, you know, seasons that potentially changed the game, I do think that that Josh, for better or worse, did implement something intentionally or not that has definitely entered the conversation with Big Brother for sure, where this is a strategy that people now use. If you're not using this strategy for within Big Brother of, you know, saying things in goodbye messages, then you're not really managing the jury to your optimum potential. In Survivor, that works a little differently. You don't have goodbye messages. And you usually, like, the importance of blindsiding people is a little bit higher because you now have the shot in the dark and you have idols and you have all kinds of ways that people can turn it around on you. So that particular aspect is a little different. But the idea that it's okay to potentially go to the end with somebody that is a big threat, because you can still manage to beat them as long as you can out-talk them at the end. And maybe you put in some work, maybe you have an idol in your back pocket that you can show, if you can present it in the right way. There are different ways of winning that don't always require voting somebody out.
Yeah. You know, and in Survivor, I mean, this was a thing like back in like around when Russell went to the end and lost. But then, you know, Boston Rob went to the end and won, but then Coach went to the end and lost. It used to be more of a thing of like, okay, I'm going to bring this person to the end and the jury won't necessarily give it to them. But I feel like that it has been quite some time since that has really been the thought on Survivor, where we've had a jury who, you know, ultimately was like somewhat punitive towards somebody on the jury. Am I missing anybody?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, going back at least, you know, four seasons or so, I think that it's been a while since we've at least heard the narrative of like, oh, it was a bitter jury.
And I also just don't get it twisted. I don't want to make it sound like this was a bitter jury. We're talking about how Mike went in mm-hmm. as probably on paper. A lot of people probably thought that Mike was going to win, and the jury had issues with Mike's game that came up at the Final Tropical Council, and Marianne really dazzled in the Final Tropical Council.
Yes, and I wouldn't say that this is a situation where Mike lost so much as I think it was that Marianne won. Like, Marianne overcame Mike in the final stretch. She had been sort of like running behind him for a little while, like leaving him out in front, and then did a sprint right in front of him before the finish line, kind of. In a way, she was actually ahead of him the whole time because she was always going to be able to do that. But yes, I think that I think you have to be careful of this line of thinking as well. Like, this isn't the end all be all. You can't just always rely on the final tribal or, the things that you're doing, because this is sort of a pitfall that I think a lot of people had in the Russell Hance era where they were like, well, I'll take the Russell Hance then. Like, I will be the person that beats the people that that they're bitter against. And then they go on to lose because people are mad at you for just bringing that person to the end and not doing anything. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just be sitting there and be like, I think I'm going to be in the end if I don't do anything. So I'm just going to sit here and hope that my final tribal thing works out. You need to be planting seeds. You need to be actively doing things in the game so that you can prove to the jury in the end, because it's not just likability, and it's not just that the jury is bitter or mad at the person next to you. It's also that you're able to win their respect. I think that's a key element of it.
You can't be looked at as an accomplice of the person who they are mad at.
Exactly. You need to be separate from that person and respectable on your own right, in your own right. And I think that's exactly what Marianne is able to do when she's able to sell a narrative of her game that is separate from Mike's, separate from Taku's in general. This was my game. I was doing this. This is how I felt. And sells that narrative in an impressive way with the passion. I think that's another huge element, the passion that she's selling it with, pulling out the idol surprises, change up how they view your game, you know, making small changes here or there, like, oh, you might've thought that this was happening, but actually something slightly different was happening. It's usually not enough. You need to really shake up. Like, I had an idol this whole time, and then they're like, whoa, hold on. That changes my entire perception of your game. Now I'm going to start from scratch and listen to what you're saying versus, like, you know, I had an idol this whole time and it didn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that Marianne got Mike to play the idol on her when she had an idol in her pocket, I think is a huge part of why pulling out that idol made a huge impact on the jury.
Yeah. I also like what you said about the passion, because that I think that we've seen certainly in season 41 and season 42, like, when the jury has you backpedaling, that's a tough luck to overcome, where we saw Marianne, certainly, like, she was able to only, you know, move the ball forward. She wasn't, like, going backwards or having to apologize for any of the things that she did. I think that from Kevin in Big Brother Canada, another, like, a really passionate final tribal council performance, I think that does a lot with the jury.
For sure. Yes. And I think what you mentioned about being on the back pedal is huge as well. We did see an instance where Marianne had Jonathan arguing with her about whether or not it was her move to take out Omer. Right. And I went into Final Tribal thinking this is one of the big things on her resume, that she is the one that pushed that move when Mike and Jonathan were too scared to do it. Right. But when Jonathan pushes back, she kind of just goes, okay. She agrees and she moves on quickly because it's a losing game. Mm-hmm. Like, if Jonathan isn't going to admit or is capable of seeing that it wasn't his move and that it was her move or whatever it is, then she's never going to win with him. And getting caught up in a back and forth where she's on the defensive trying to say, like, no, I did do this. I did do this. And somebody saying, no, you didn't. That's not a good look. So she quickly moved on from it and went to other things, other backup plans for moves that she made. And I think that was another huge part of why she was able to be so effective in Final Tribal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And something bad that Mike did in the Final Tribal Council, when he came in and said, you know, I only told one lie in this game. Like, I think that you never want to sort of, like, quantify. I think he could just easily said, like, you know, I tried to only lie when I had to would have been better. But when the fact when people are like, well, you lied to me. Hold on. Was that a lie to me? And then he had to define what a lie was. And, well, you had actually gone against me. So it was I thought I had a way out there. So I think that was definitely the wrong foot to start on with this jury.
Definitely. And I think that in general, for Mike, his story is already out there. He doesn't know everything about it, though. That's and self-awareness is something that, of course, is an obvious, like huge, huge benefit in a final tribal situation. Mike didn't have that for his game. He was unsure about different aspects of his game. And I think that even if you feel like you know what your game was, you should still try to be a little bit careful about the language you use when describing it. Like, for instance, and I think this is something that worked for Marianne, but I think it was risky. When she explained the idol situation and how she guaranteed herself final three, she said, well, I knew that Jonathan would do this and Mike would do this and Omer would do this and Lindsay would do this. And that was like, that was a lot of different claims at once that any one of them could have been like, I wasn't going to do that. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of shakes the whole thing. Now, luckily that didn't happen because Marianne was spot on, but that is a riskier play that I would maybe hesitate to do. I would just say I guaranteed me final three because of X, Y, and Z, like just more general reasons. But when Mike talks about like, hey, I only lied once. I played an honest game. I did this. When people are asking him questions that are like, do you think you played an honest game? Do you think you betrayed people? Like, why did you betray this person? And he's trying to justify those moves like, well, I didn't betray anybody until they betrayed me first. I didn't lie to anybody until they lied to me first. Roxor is the only person I actively sort of like, betrayed preemptively, essentially. That's obviously no good. Sometimes the people will be like, okay, yeah, that's kind of right. But sometimes... you've got Omer on the jury saying, no, I tricked him into doing this. I lied to him about high. And so if I'm Mike, I think the thing I'm falling back on every time is I did what I had to do to get here, because that's the one thing that they cannot disagree with, right? Like I did, do you think you betrayed people to get to the end? Whether or not I think I did, I'm going to say, you know, at the end of the day, I did what I had to do to get myself sitting here in front of all of you. And that's not like necessarily the best answer in the world, but it's at least not going to put you in the negative, right? Like, they can't disagree that you are sitting there in the final three and that some ways the moves that you made got them there.
Yeah. Or even like I came out here saying I was going to play this type of game, but as the game got more complicated, I had to, you know, make the decision to change up how I was playing the game. And I had to, you know, do things that I'm not proud of to get here, but that was the only way I could get past people like High and, whoever's sitting on the jury.
Yeah. I think that can work. I think maybe a little bit risky though, to proposition it as like I wanted to play this way and then I found that I couldn't.
I would say like if you made it like an active decision of I had to decide to do a different thing of it's not like, oh, it just slipped out. It just happened. I had to analyze what was going on and made the decision to change my strategy at halftime and go and play the game a different way.
Yeah. And I think if you go that route, and I think in general, you should do this as well. Like whether it's, I did what I had to do, or I made the decision at this point. It's always because I looked at High and he was so smart and he was so good and everybody loved him. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to beat him. And I knew that he was way too smart to I couldn't wait. I knew it had to be sooner rather than later, because if I waited any longer, he would have caught on to me. And so I had to do it then. The typical sort of like pump them up, make them include them in the narrative, make them feel like they're like the worst part of the entire game for them. When they lost, it was part of a larger narrative where this person eventually wins. And it's because they were so good that they left.
Tarrant, let's take a question from Sean Hartman, who says, what do you think is the biggest thing future players should take away from Marianne's winning game?
I think the biggest thing is sort of what we just talked about, right? The fact that she didn't need to be the big threat ever in the game. Even in the final three, people didn't see her as the big threat. And then she still won in a dominating fashion. And that's because once they couldn't get rid of her, she turned it on so well that she wins the game. So all of that jury management stuff is huge. But again, it's sort of like, I think it's interesting to look at Omer versus Marianne, because Omer was trying to run the game without people seeing that he was running the game, whereas Marianne was mostly just trying to survive until a certain point where she started to turn on a little more, and she kind of just played the game in front of her. So it's not like she was intentionally trying to lie low until a certain point. It was more that that was sort of like the cards that were dealt to her, and she played as well as she could, whereas Omer was like trying to pretend to be a Marianne while actually being the high or whoever it is that, you know, people think are running the game. And for Omer, he ran out of runway. It's at some point they caught on and they got rid of him. With Marianne, she was able to basically peak at just the right time. And like I said, I don't think that she intentionally peaked at that time. I think it was more that like opportunities were presented to her in a way where she was able to take those opportunities and run with them and make the most of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to try to intentionally play a Marianne game, I think that's kind of difficult. I don't think you can go in and be like, okay, I'm going to be the Marianne. I'm just going to like lie low and be on the outs and be an option for somebody to vote out for a while, and that, but be too likable to actually vote out. And then toward the end, I'm going to really kick it into gear because I've got an idol and I can do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult game to replicate, I think. But the idea that you can be in that position and still be in a winning position, like say if you're somebody like Romeo and you are locked out, basically, I think the thing to take away is if you are in a bad spot, there's still a lot of hope left, and don't give up that hope. Don't walk around feeling defeated. Don't like be thinking about what is my end game plan. If people are looking to bring me along for a while, what am I going to say in the end? What things can I do right now to give my story later some evidence that I can use? How can I interfere with different relationships? How can I build more relationships? All of those things I think are huge. And I think those are the things that you should really look at when it comes to Marianne's game.
I do want to add the caveat that Taryn and I are recording this before I've had the chance to start doing any of my deep dive interviews. And I have a couple scheduled in the next couple of days, including getting the chance to talk to Marianne more. So I will reserve the right to, you know, change up what we're saying about Marianne's game.
Yeah.
If new information comes to light. But I feel like that with Marianne, that she really like came out there and really, you know, let her freak flag fly of like, hey, I'm just here for fun. Like, you know, mm-hmm. She says in her confessionals about how, hey, I'm here to win early on. But I think that she really gave out vibes of, hey, I'm just a super fan. I'm here for a good time. And, you know, even like talking about Zach and, you know, I think she did a lot of things that were just like, you know, just tried to like, this was, you know, oh, this is so much fun. I'm here on Survivor. And I think that she really did play those things up intentionally at times, especially at the merge. She talked about how she noticed that the players who were young and seemingly strategic were getting picked off. And so I think she was able to sort of like ride that for a while. And then At the very end, she was able to convince people that, like, you thought I was here just for fun. I actually was playing the game the whole time. And I think that she benefited from being on a strong tribe from the pre-merge, a cohesive tribe in the pre-merge where, you know, Marianne knew she was on the bottom at Taku, but she wasn't like a Tori where she's like, I can't wait to get to the merge so I can flip on these idiots who they think I'm on the bottom. Wait until, you know, she was like, hey, I'm going to stick with this group. Like, she was like just as much Taku strong as anybody. And that was the only group that didn't turn on itself at the merge. So I think that like an important thing from her pre-merge game is just because you're on the bottom of your tribe and you go into the merge, you don't have to be looking to flip right away. Like there's room to play like from the bottom of the majority tribe.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I, in some ways, it's like, I feel like the advice I usually give, especially for Brother, is advice that I think often would be better for television. I feel like the advice we're giving right now is maybe not the best for television, which is like, hey, if you're part of a majority and you're at the bottom, it's not the worst thing in the world to ride that for a little while. But
just to add to that, would anybody say Marianne was not good television? I mean, she,
very true.
You don't have to be like, you know, I'm flipping every vote. You can just be good television, be your authentic self and, you know, bring a lot of energy to your confessionals. You know, bring a lot of energy to the camp life. And that's how, you know, Marianne, got so much screen time in the season, not because she was, you know, flipping.
Yeah. And I think that that's a huge part of it as well. When you talk about like Marianne letting her freak flag fly, like she is herself. I think that's another huge part of why it works for her to play the way that she did and have such a dominating performance in the end, is that nobody ever doubted that she was Marianne. And she didn't try to be anybody else. She didn't try to play as anybody else. She toned down the strategic aspects of herself in order to maintain a certain level of, you know, low level of threat. But she was very unapologetically who she was. And she, whether that hurt her in the game or helped her in the game, she didn't change who she was for the sake of fitting in or anything like that. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's huge. I think, and again, that comes down to self-awareness, knowing who you are going into the game, and not trying to just like completely pretend to be somebody else entirely. And again, like there's a difference between like, I'm a really strategic person and I'm going to pretend I'm not. And like, hey, I'm, you know, Marianne and I think Zach's cute. But I'm going to keep that. I'm going to not be too weird because I don't want people to be weirded out by me. Like that's what I think you need to avoid doing. I think a lot of people tone their own personality down. I think Jonathan is a great example of this, right? Where Jonathan talked constantly about how, well, my personality, I'm too intense, for people and, you know, my size and stuff, I've got to act a certain way or else people will think I'm this or that. It just doesn't work. At some point you come out, you can't hide who you are. And with Jonathan, it seems like that happened, right? Like mm-hmm. He was constantly talking, I can't complain too much because they'll be mad at me. And then we're seeing constant scenes of him complaining way too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And him trying to not complain seems to only make it worse. And it's just like, this is not working. And I think it obviously helps if your personality is one that is likable. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you just have to be yourself and be genuine about who you are while being not as genuine about the strategic decisions that you're making. I think that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say it's not just true in Survivor. You know, these podcasts are not just for people who are going to play Survivor one day, but I think that they're true in life also, that I know that, you know, Taryn and I have, you know, seen so many up and coming podcasters come through in talking with us. And I think the people that like have really like broken out as like podcasters and people who have sort of like caught on with the audience immediately are not the people that are sort of like doing an impression of what you think a good podcaster is supposed to be. I think the people that have been, you know, more of their authentic selves on a podcast and sort of like, you know, let us see a little bit of their weirdness, I think are the people that have really always connected with the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because at the end of the day, anybody can try to be like the most neutral, agreeable person in the world. And lots of people do. And so you see the same thing over and over and that's just kind of boring. People want to see who you are. They want to feel like they can relate to you because most people aren't neutral, boring, no opinion people. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it applies to Survivor in the sense that like, if you're never giving any opinions, if you're never, you know, trying to lead anything, or even just like be a part of anything, you know, cause you're just like, nah, I like this person. And I also like this person. And I also like this person. You know, we're all fine. Like if that's who you are and you're just like, man, it's all about love, man. Like that's fine. Cause that's who you are. Right. But if it's clear, if you're like giving eye rolls to yourself every time you look at somebody and then somebody comes up to you, you're like, So Jonathan A, and you're like, nah, he's great. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. They're gonna be like, okay, this person's lying to me. I can't connect to this person at all.
Let's take one from Baby Andy. The great Baby Andy says, challengeability did not play a major factor in either Erica or Marianne's win. We've seen Ricard and Lindsay get targeted for their individual challengeability, and Jonathan did not get jury respect, even though he was dominant in the pre-merge. How, in the new era, how important is it to be good at challenges, especially as it compares to Big Brother, where we've seen it becomes more important over time? Taryn, how big of a deal is success in the challenges in the new era of Survivor?
I think it's becoming less of a big deal. You know, I think it comes in waves, but, you know, I think sort of like the peak of it is probably like the Mike Holloway, right? Where it's like, well, I gotta give it to him. Mm-hmm. I feel like that doesn't exist as much anymore, where it's like, and I think a big part of it too is, it's not just about the challenges on Survivor, at least. It's also, did the challenges matter? Like, if Jonathan runs the table on all the immunity challenges up until the final three, does he get votes? Probably not, because he wasn't the target anyway. He probably didn't need those challenges because nobody was threatened by him. If Jonathan is the target, if he is what I think maybe, you know, he thought he was, or some other people thought he was, where it's mm-hmm. like he is obviously going to win if he gets to the end, and then he wins every challenge and nobody can vote him, nobody has a chance to vote him out, then he's got a great case. Like, they couldn't do it. They tried, they wanted to, but they couldn't. That's always a great case. But even that case, I think, is a little bit less effective in the current era of Survivor, because there are so many people who are coming into the game with different perspectives and who are bigger fans of the show, and they want to see a more well-rounded person win the game. Somebody who is, you know, being able to, who is able to strategize and communicate effectively, and isn't just like out there, you know, beasting challenges. So I don't think challenges matter as much, especially in Survivor. You know, if we're comparing to Big Brother, in Big Brother, challenges give you power, mm-hmm. and that can change the perception of you by the other players. In Survivor, it's just giving you immunity. You don't really have power over anybody else, except for like the final four immunity, where you can choose one person. But even then, your power is immediately undermined by the fact that it's then the two remaining people, you know, winning themselves to the end. So it doesn't seem like you have that much power.
Yeah, I don't think that winning the challenges really matters all that much in Survivor these days, especially in the post-merge. I think the only exception is when a person needed it. I mean, it's really, yeah. I think that's sort of like the challenges are like properly rated. I mean, that's the idea of, you know, what it was there for, where, okay, if you feel like you are going to go home tonight, win this challenge and you will be safe. And I think that in these two seasons, probably Ricard was the person who probably benefited the most from, like, that there were times where his back was against the wall, that there was a chance that he was going to go. He was able to, you know, win some immunities, correct? Does that sound right?
Yes. Yeah. He won a couple of immunities.
Final six, I think he won. He won an immunity also. So there were times where, you know, he was a potential person to go home. He won immunities. And I think that people, like, I remember Danny giving him credit of like, you know, you all thought you were going to beat this man today. I took it seriously. And, you know, that's why I said we should have got him out last time. So I think in that case, like, it has helped. But in season 42, I think that what was impressive was that I think that Lindsay was beating Jonathan to win those immunities. But I feel like that had Jonathan not been there, I don't know if people would have looked at what Lindsay was doing as like uber impressive.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I think that, I mean, this is something that I've talked about for a little while, but I do think there is some validity to the strategy of intentionally putting a target on your back. It's sort of the opposite of what I've been talking about, where it's like, you don't need a target on your back. You don't need to be the big threat in order to win at the end. But if you feel like your case is very bad to win the game, or you're worried about, you know, trying to out-talk somebody who's a very good talker and is probably going to be there, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to like intentionally try and like proclaim that you made a big move or like get a target on, like say you have an idol in your pocket, it's good to five. Get the votes on you intentionally at five so that you can play the idol.
Yeah.
Negate the votes and be like, whoa, he survived. And then now you just need to either win final four immunity or fire. Mm-hmm. And you're in final three. And it's like, they tried to get me out because they knew I was the big threat. They knew I was the big target, but I blocked them at every turn. Like that's not the worst Hail Mary in the world. If you're sitting there, at final
I thought
six.
Marianne might've done that in this season where we coming into that final five episode. I was like, oh wait, watch this now. You know, you thought that move was big. Wait until is Marianne potentially going to try to get votes on herself there so she could be, you know, cast the soul vote to go home. Did not seem like that was on her mind.
No, but she could have used her idol on Lindsay to do something similar where it's like, hey, I just got Mike to use an idol on me, then turned around and messed with his plans. I'm the big target.
I mean, Romeo like attempted to do this with the fake idol. It's like, just so you know, fake idol, you know.
And I respect the attempt. Unfortunately, like it just didn't play because it wasn't real and he didn't need it. So it was like, you know, like I don't think anybody on the jury was like, oh man, they were about to vote for Romeo if not for that fake immunity idol. You know, maybe if they had been, maybe if they'd been talking about it, like, you know, if he could craft some kind of narrative where it mattered that he had that fake idol. But the problem is that at that point, the respect level for his game was so low that it just wasn't working. So he needed to build something ahead of time to make that work. And it just didn't.
Okay. There's a question from Ricky who says, and in the new 26-day season, if you find yourself at the bottom post-merge, what are the new strategies that players should use to play from the bottom during these quicker games? How could Romeo have played from his position better? I think it's a little interesting. And I'd been making the comparison between Survivor and Big Brother, where I think that, you know, for Marianne, had this been a Big Brother season, I'm not sure if Marianne could have like come from the deficit that she was at to go from like where she was at the final six to ultimately come out of that Omer vote in such a like a great position. I feel like that we don't see those types of swings happen normally in Big Brother. And, you know, stop me if you disagree. For Romeo, I feel like that he's somebody who, you know, was just, you know, got into an untenable position and there was just no way out for him to get into a winning spot after a certain point.
That's how it felt. And it's hard to talk about because I feel like we didn't see why. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm sure was talked about a lot during the season, but like basically when the merge hit, everyone was like, nah, Romeo sucks. He's paranoid. We don't like him anymore. And like, okay. Is something happened there socially where things just weren't clicking for other people apparently. And because of that, you know, we talked about likability when it comes to that final tribal situation, winning the respect of the jurors. It's a lot harder to do that if they don't like you very much because they don't have a lot of incentive to respect you. And so if people didn't respect you or particularly like you through most of the game, they're not just going to like turn around and both like you and respect you out of nowhere. And so, you know, I think that for Romeo, it was about just focusing on social bonds more. I think that my guess for what he was doing throughout most of the merge portion of the game is that he was presenting himself as a free agent. You know, come to me for a vote. If you need one, I'm willing to vote wherever you need me to go. I'm going to have like individual strategic relationships with people, which is great. It kind of probably helped keep him afloat for a little while, but it didn't seem like those relationships were very personal, that he wasn't really bonding with people too much. The one time we did see him bond with Hai, it didn't seem to really go anywhere. And then they got into a fight. And it was like who out there really stuck up for Romeo, cared about Romeo? It didn't seem like that existed. And that's sort of like the foundation that you need to start with to start building anything else. So I think that's what he probably needed to focus on. Maybe he tried and it just didn't work.
Yeah, I think that, you have to look at Romeo sort of like in conjunction with Marianne also, who were two of the players who were considered on the bottom through most of the post-merge. But I think that with Marianne, it was like, oh, don't worry about Marianne. She's harmless. You know, Marianne, you know, she's just here for fun. She can be in these conversations if we want her to. But, you know, nobody talked to Romeo because Romeo, that he's scheming. Just don't give him anything. Freeze him out. And I think that he was looked at somebody who, you know, he's on the bottom. And, you know, we can't even tell him the right person to vote for because we know he's going to go and tell people where he just like was in a position. And it's so interesting because this almost never happens in Survivor where somebody's in such a good position coming into the merge and then like has, you know, tight allies and then basically is just like frozen out when they get to the merge. And I don't think he knew how to handle that in the first couple days of the merge.
Yeah, and I think that maybe he ended up jumping the gun a little bit, trying to make bigger plays without that foundational support, and that's what really like sunk him even further. Whereas we talk about Marianne intentionally playing down her strategic side, playing up the social, you know, goofball side. You know, Romeo is like the second he got a scrap, he bet it all on black. And it was like, whoa, like, no, it's like he ran and tried to make a plan, like, I gotta get Jonathan out or like whatever. Right. Or like, you know, he used every single little bit that he had to try to strategically maneuver, including his vote where he would vote, you know, cast rogue votes and then blame it on people or deny it. And it was like you don't have enough to actually be betting here. Mm-hmm. You need to build up your pot first, in order to get there. But, and so when he's constantly failing with these scraps, you're like, I can't even give him scraps. You gotta show that people can trust you to give you those scraps. And then you start to hoard them. And then eventually you've got something to play with. Like exactly what Marianne.
Yeah. And in his exit interview, he talked about how, you know, he was, seen as like, talking to Tori, or that one of the things, that was like, he had said was that him and Drea said, okay, well, let's try to downplay how close we are. And it's almost like that thing where it's like, hey, we're going to pretend this. And then like the thing that you're pretending, like ultimately happens, because it feels too real. And because he was talking to Tori too much, Romeo had said that Drea is like, why is he talking to Tori? That's my nemesis. So that he sort of got like the Tory stink on him from being like too close with Tory and talking to her too much at the merge. And I think that he was looked at as sort of like from a different lens the rest of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a tricky thing. But, you know, there were other people like Marianne was able to talk to Tori and got away with it. Right. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, being able to actually hide that sort of thing. Is the key there.
Okay. Let's take a question from Ben from St. Louis. Hey, Rob, now that hindsight is 2020, I can't stop thinking about the Mariah boot episode. Omer made the decision to keep Marianne, very similar to Shan's decision to keep Ricard over Jeannie in Marianne's win and Ricard's deep run in 41. That is that proof that keeping the strategic superfan over the loyal player is a huge mistake, or is there merit to having a strategic partner at the merge? Okay. So ultimately, you know, Shan is going to keep Ricard. I think it's a little different in the case of Omer with, I think that Marianne was like another option, that, you know, it's presented in the show for Omer that Jonathan is a close number. We saw the close relationship that Omer and Lindsay have in the game. I'm not sure how tight necessarily Omer and Marianne were as strategic partners at that point in the game. So I think it's a little bit different, but interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, it's always, there's always the dilemma here is, there's a player who, and we don't really know how, Mariah would have played, because we didn't see much of her, but, the idea of a player who would just be a loyal number, would never consider wavering, would just be, you know, locked in with you versus somebody like Marianne, who is a little bit more of a wild card. They could flip if they feel like it benefits them. But at the same time, you know, they are going to be more willing to make moves with you and be a little bit, you know, sneaky with you if you need that. Whereas somebody that's entirely based on like a personal connection, if they catch you being sketchy, they might really just hard bounce off of you and never work with you again. And at the same time, if they bond with somebody else even stronger, then now you've lost them. So I think you really have to be able to know, and I'm sure it's really hard to know after only a couple of days, how bonded to this person you are. Because in my eyes, there's very few things that are as valuable as just a complete lock loyal player to you. Yeah. And so in that sense, I would definitely be inclined to keep that loyal player, but you have to make sure it's to you and not to anybody else. Mm-hmm. And you have to make sure that, that also like the flip side of the double-edged sword aspect of it is if they're so not strategically inclined that they won't understand you trying to make it seem like you're not that close to them. Like, are you going to be able to hold on to them without being an obvious pair, which kind of like for somebody like Omer, who is really trying to lie low, would really make him stand out if it's like, well, Omer's got Mariah on this, what's going on there? Mm-hmm. So you really have to pay attention to that. I think if I were to guess what Omer was thinking, I would guess that he felt like he could just work with Marianne more. And I think there are some huge positives to that, that somebody like Marianne, I think, is still a social player, still somebody who works on loyalty. I don't think Marianne is going to betray somebody easily. I think that it took a little bit for her to turn on Omer like she did, but also is going to be much more willing to like work with you on some tricky votes. Like, hey, we need Jonathan out. How is Mariah going to feel about that? What, I thought we were Taku strong. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, there are pluses and minuses. I think that you really need to evaluate the situation that you're in. I think honestly, either way, depending on what you're going to do.
Yeah. I think the two situations are a little bit different. I'm not sure exactly who Mariah might've felt the most loyalty to. Perhaps it was Jackson. I'm not sure if she was sort of like a person who was maybe a little bit, they looked at her as loyal, but I don't know if she necessarily had like a tight confidant in that group, where Marianne was a little bit more of like the rah-rah, like Taku 4 person. But also that in the other case where Jeannie like has sort of like sworn allegiance to Shan, that I think that Shan or Jeannie was a person that was never going to betray Shan and where she wanted to go. So that to me seems like the bigger misstep to keep Ricard and ultimately get rid of Jeannie in that spot. I was going to say also that both of them, this was a case of like in both cases, proximity to an advantage was kept, but I had just gone back and rewatched those episodes. They didn't know going into that tribal council that Marianne had the extra vote yet. When they come back from the tribal council where Mariah, and maybe Marianne like might have alluded to the fact that she had an advantage, but she doesn't know for sure she has an extra vote until they come back from that tribal council.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the point about Ricard and Jeannie as well is solid. Cause like in that situation, I don't think Shan needed a Ricard. Mm-hmm. I think that she was carrying him socially, into the merge. She already had other options. And so I think for her, just having somebody that was like lock loyal, would have been much more valuable than somebody that she could like strategically maneuver with. Cause I think she already got to that point at that point in the game.
Mm-hmm. Like he had that extra vote. Like he was like, I'm going to hold on to this until the tribal council. So it would have been like, also like for her flushing away that advantage, that she had gotten from JD.
Which is true. Like, I get that.
But Jeannie is a literal extra vote every round.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And how often do you really, I know that it was used to affect this season, but like the times in which an extra vote have really come into play are pretty rare. Mm-hmm. So, I'm willing to give up an extra vote in order to win, to get like a loyal player on board heading into a merge.
Taryn, let me bring in a question from the great Greg Dunlap, who says, something that we've seen for two seasons now is the dominance of smaller voting groups, be they tribes or twists in the post-merge. We started with three tribes and never swapped to two. And in the post-merge, I think we only had one completely normal full cast vote between the double elimination, the hourglass, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that I think we also had normal votes at six and five also as well. Jeff had mentioned now that he really likes the small groups and wants to see them more in the future. How does this focus on smaller group dynamics change things for players who are interested in playing in future seasons? So, again, just to clarify that there were it was a normal vote at 11, 8, 6, and 5. Those were the only normal votes from, you know, from the final 12 on. Do you have any thoughts on the effect of smaller groups in Survivor here?
I mean, I think I agree with Jeff. I like them in terms of how they shake up the structure of the game. I mean, you know, something that I was thinking about is like, when is the last time we had a pagonging in Survivor? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like I don't even hear that term much anymore. And I think it's in large part because of, you know, the new meta game where you don't stick with one group, you chop down the heads, the poke up. But another part of it is, you know, the different swapping and the way that, you know, things are being shaken up by the merge votes. I love the idea of splitting the tribe into smaller groups, because if it's a somewhat regular thing, what it means is you need to be prepared for that kind of vote. You need to not only be secure in your numbers, but you need to be secure with the people who are not in your group, because you might end up locked in a position where you're relying on some of those other relationships. And that's interesting to me. That means that there's much more to be doing in the game other than just, you know, locking down six people and saying, all right, we've got a buddy system. Could you imagine on Redemption Island, if this twist were in play and then Rob gets stuck with, you know, five Zapateras or whatever, mm-hmm. Right? Now in order to prep for that, he's got to actually work on his relationship with those people as well. And so I think that makes the game more interesting. And I think that's the solve for it as well, which is, it's more like Big Brother in this way. In Big Brother, any one person can win HOH and nominate two other people and force everybody else to vote between those two people, which means you need to be good with as many people as possible, because any one of them can win that power. Same is kind of true in Survivor, where you might get stuck in a group with people that you might be relying on their votes. So you need to be playing that kind of more Omer style of game if you're playing his style of game, which is connecting with as many people as possible, having as many options as possible. Different groups mean, okay, in this group, I'm going to go with Tori and Romeo, and now we've got three of five. And in this group, I've got High and Mike and Jonathan. We got four or five. That's great. Or, you know, similar to Marianne's strategy, in any group, I'm not the biggest threat. That's riskier because you never fully know, and there might be people that are grouped up there, but it's still like the chances of you being targeted a little bit smaller if you're not as much of a threat. So I like what it does to the game, and I think it just means that you need more backup plans, doing more work, creating more relationships, all of those things.
The thing that I don't like about the smaller tribes is that I feel like that for players who are sort of like in the early game, where it's just basically once if there's a decision made, okay, it's you. I feel like there's the shot in the dark now, but alternative to that, you don't have a lot of options, where I feel like that, you know, tribe of eight, tribe of nine, even 10, you know, you have a lot of different ways that you could potentially play the first couple of votes.
It's very true. And I feel like, you know, I think it's important that not every vote is like that. I think having one vote here or there, and I think that also establishing the merge dynamic first, right? Like a regular merge vote or two, and then maybe shake it up once there's already been, you know, a group established. Because yeah, you're right. I think that the problem with it is that once you do get into those smaller groups, you're probably locked it. Like, it's like, okay, this is how it's going to play out based on this group. Mm-hmm. There's one person that can be targeted, and if they don't win immunity, then they're out. And that's, it's a little bit more likely to be like that, but But I do think it is kind of fun to shake things up a little bit.
Yeah. That also being said, I really don't like big tribes at the merge. So I kind of like what they've done with the 6 and 6, you know, barring like how they've executed on the hourglass. But I do feel like that they did correct something that I thought was bad in, you know, modern day Survivor, where we get a 13 person merge and all right, get ready for, you know, an 11-2 vote coming up at the merge, where it's just like, okay, who's the easiest person to decide? Okay, it's not even like the biggest threat. It's like, okay, who's the, you know, who's the person here that nobody likes? All right, pick them off at the merge, and we get like a very lopsided merge vote. If anything, I'm wondering if maybe we should, instead of like go through the whole hourglass situation of you get to 12, why don't we go into back to 2 tribes of 6?
Yeah.
2 tribes of 6 and get it to and merge at 10. And then don't you know, split up again at 10.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, I think that, although I will say, I think that like it, once you go back down to 2, I guess you'd hope at that point that the lines are blurred enough that like those in those tribes don't last long enough that they wouldn't like really stick together. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think there'd be, for like, if I was playing, I'd push as hard as possible. Like if we get the numbers advantage, on a 6-6 and we go into the merge at like 6-4, I'm going to be like, that's it. We're final 6. Easy. Right.
Yeah. But I feel like that, especially with this accelerated time frame of like, mm-hmm. Are you with this group for 3 days? Like, is that enough time that you're gonna, like, you've made bonds that's going to really like keep you together for the whole game? Like, it's not like that, you know, you've spent, you know, 6 or 7 days together. You know, if it's, mm-hmm. if it's that quick and you're back with, you know, you're coming from a tribe of 6, maybe best case scenario, there's 3 people from your original tribe. I'm not sure how like set in stone that is if you end up on this new tribe of 6.
I think it's worth experimenting with.
Yeah. I like that better because the hourglass is trash. And so yeah, I mean, we need to get rid of
the hourglass.
But basically do the whole thing. You're like, okay, we get to the merge. Okay. We're going to divide you into 2 groups of 6. Okay. Somebody's going to there'll be a big feast. Maybe it's not the merge feast, but you know, okay. 6 of you are going to go to Applebee's and whatever. And then, you know, you're immune. That group, they might have a tribal council that night. You know, it's like, okay, a quick tribal council. And then maybe, you know, one more tribal council. And now you have 10. I think that's a much more fair way to do it than, you know, whatever this was in 41 and 42.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. John P wants to know, is running the merge a good thing anymore? Will we ever see another alliance run the merge and win the game? Or is the crumbling inevitable in the new era? This is like what you're talking about with Pagangi. Taku did dominate the post-merge game.
Yes.
Although ironically, only one of the 4 Taku. It's interesting, right? Like they get to the final 6. There's 4 of them. One that they do.
3 of those 4 were in the majority alliance. Yeah. The one that wasn't is the one that won.
Yeah, they do as bad as possible from the final 6 out. And ultimately, the person on the bottom and then the 2 people who are non-Taku get to the final 3.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's being in the majority. It's interesting because in Survivor, being in the majority used to be even more solid than it was in, say, Big Brother, where, you know, the majority, it matters. But again, anybody outside of the majority could still win and put you in danger. Whereas in Survivor, if you have a majority and you lock that in, you can't be stopped. It's very difficult for somebody to take somebody out from the majority if the majority stays solid. We're now seeing in Survivor that it's actually easier to overcome the majority than in Big Brother lately because of the new meta of the game, I think primarily, where it's like, look, I need to make sure that I'm going down in a winning position. And this majority is too big. If it's a majority of 7, that only gets me to 7. 7 is not enough, because... In a weird way, and you know, I'm pretty critical of the fire making thing. I don't love it. I also don't like the final 3. But what it does do is it kind of forces you to make moves even earlier. Because if you wait until final 7 or final 6 to make your move, it might be too late. It's very easily you know, immunity, idol, fire, nothing you can do. Right. There's just a couple of rounds to make that move. It's, there's too much, there's too much lack of control in those final few rounds. So you need to make those moves earlier. And that, I think, inhibits a majority's ability to stay a majority for a long period of time. So is it important to be in control? I mean, I would still prefer to be in the majority come the merge. I don't need to be running the majority in the merge. I would very happily, especially if it's a 12 person merge, give it to somebody else. They can be in charge. They can run things. I'll let them run things for a while, as long as they're not taking out like my allies. And I think that's a huge part of how Taku, you know, dominated in the season up until a point, which is that they kept their Marianne around. Like they kept their pieces around. Hai lost his, Drea lost hers, kind of gave it up, I guess. And you know, even then, other like Roxroy left, like people were just losing their allies and allowing the other people to continue to build theirs, which is why you ultimately see, you know, Omer in the position that he ultimately becomes to, and Lindsay also like in a good position to win. And then Marianne ultimately does win. So I think that's big. Like you don't need to be in charge, but also don't be losing.
Yeah. I think that just looking at these two seasons, like I'm wondering if like sort of the unified theory that we sort of like touched on earlier is like the ideal positioning in Survivor as being be at the bottom of the majority.
Yeah.
That's like right where you want to be. Yeah.
At the bottom of the majority, to the extent that people aren't even bothering to take out your people to weaken you because you're already weak. Right.
Yeah. And then when people take out the people who are at the top of the majority, you know, you are like in a really good position to like fall in and be at the bottom of, you know, that new majority.
Yes. I think the, like being at the bottom of the majority is great until you get to a point where that majority starts picking off your allies. That's when you need to start changing things. In my eyes. Because I think that Hai loses the game when Lydia leaves. Yes. I think that like Mike to some degree, Jonathan, like these dudes, they start to lose the game when Roxroy leaves. And so it's important to make sure that your pieces stay intact, because if you wait too long and you've lost all your allies and then the shot gets taken at the big dogs, you don't have any pieces to do anything about it. Like, okay, you've moved up a notch, but now there's just too many people still in front of you. You know, and it's fine if you're able to make new connections and in new allies, that's okay. It's fine to lose one in order to gain another, but you need to make sure that you're still in a good position, I think.
Okay. And then, off of that, Dan Sedensky wants to know, how can someone make moves in the mid merge and make it to the end?
You know, I feel like Omer is a great example of how to play the mastermind version of the modern era of Survivor. Obviously Marianne is the one that wins the game. But she didn't win the game in like the sort of like, I controlled everything. I was the mastermind. I drove every vote kind of way. She won in a very impressive, different kind of way. And again, you need to make sure you know who you are and the kind of game that you're apt to play. But ultimately, I think Omer came very close and he kind of maybe tripped up at the finish line a little bit.
Here's my question, Taryn. Was Omer's plan ever going to work? Because I know Omer has talked a little bit about how things, once he got to Ponderosa, that there was a bit of an icy reception for him, which, you know, leads us to believe that if he got to the final three, that he could have easily gotten the same reception that Mike got from the jury.
I think that's fair. But I think that that's just true of just how you manage the jury. Like, I think it matters what kind of jury you have. And I think it matters how you manage them. You know, we have seen players like Boston Rob win and lose playing a very similar style of game. Right. And it just depends on who's there and how you manage them. You know, Kim wins in dramatic fashion, playing a very dominant style of game. And then, you know, Russell Hantz loses, right? I'm not comparing the two in strategically, but in terms of that style of game, I do think it can win. I think this style of game is the same. I think that it is a trickier game to manage because of its unique properties of the point of it being I'm staying under the radar. People don't see what I'm doing. You know, the Kims and the Boston Robs, everybody sees what they're doing, but they can't do anything about it, which makes it easy to sell their case, but people might be mad at them. In Omer's case, it was, I need them to see and then also not be mad at me. I need to accomplish two things. And I think that we just saw somebody accomplish this in Big Brother, where they were playing a very under the radar game to the point where even at the end, they didn't know that this person was going to win because they had done such a good job of managing people on their way out that it turns out they were all rooting for this person. So I think there is a way to do it. Could Omer have pulled it off? I don't know. I don't really know what was in the minds of the jury, but I do think that Omer would have performed better than Mike in Final Tribal. I think he would have owned his moves. I think he would have said I did what I had to do. You know, I was behind these moves. I made this call and I made this call and I was the, this hidden emu of the season. He would have compared himself to an animal. It would have been great. So I do think that you can win with this style of play.
We've talked a lot about what the players need to take away. And I know this isn't exactly what the show is, but Taryn, I always like to hear what you think about sort of like the production design of the game in terms of like the way that they have all of these game mechanics play out for the players and what sort of environment that creates for the players. What do you think are the biggest things that the Survivor production needs to address for this upcoming year of Survivor?
I mean, I think the big ones, like the hourglass that nobody likes. I think the do or die, which I always confuse with shot in the dark. But do or die is just terrible because if we ever get to a point where somebody dies, what kind of ending of an episode is that? Like, that's not like
you picked the wrong box.
Oh. No vote, guys. Just they're out. Okay. I think that like their best case scenario is that they portray it like, oh, the fan favorite is gonna be voted out unless this person dies, and they died, and they're like, okay, thank you. You know, the Marianne of the season didn't give out or whatever it is. But that's just, it's just a bad spot to put yourself in. I've talked about this before. So I think those are the two big, huge things that they need to address.
Anything else that's sort of, not the obvious stuff?
Not the obvious stuff. The final three is also obvious. Fire making, think is also obvious.
Yeah, just because you want to see a vote in that spot, or is there any other reason in particular?
I just think a final two is so much better. When has a final three ever made a difference other than like Ghost Island? You know, like because she got
the said that vote. They should like the jury should just vote out the person at the final three. It's like, all right, jury, you have like a little bit of power tonight. Okay, who is like cast your vote for the person who has no shot to win the game, isn't it? Is that any different than, the zero vote finalists? Like, has anybody ever come in as like the zero vote finalist? Maybe Natalie White, who then like turned the whole thing around.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, put them on the jury. You made it this far. Especially,
I enjoyed Romeo's performance at the final tribal. I liked hearing what he had to say for sure. But it didn't feel like it fit in the episode. Like that, to me, that was Romeo's like interview with you after the, like, it didn't make any difference. It was like this is clearly a battle between Mike and Marianne. Why are we spending so much time on Romeo when he's obviously not going to win? Which again is not shade to Romeo. It's just the position that he was in. So if he was voted out prior to that, I think that would make for better television. It's just always been more epic to me to have two people facing off in the end. And I also think that it's more interesting game-wise. When I think about some of like the biggest moments in Survivor, some of like the biggest, most impressive moves, like Kagyan would have been a much worse season in my eyes if it had been a final three. Mm-hmm. You know, to not get Tony getting Wu to take him would have been a huge loss to Survivor history. So, you know, I want those moments to exist for that purpose. I also find the fire making to be very boring most of the time. So I don't want to see that, but for whatever reason, they like these things. I think they've done a good job, though, in terms of encouraging the kind of gameplay that we're seeing where people are making moves left and right. And the idea of a resume, I think, is beneficial to the television producers because it is going to prevent people from being stagnant. And they're going to want to make moves. They're going to want to do these things. And for as many advantages as there are in the game, I think it's been like years since we've actually seen an idol used effectively, right? So I think that like they've actually done a pretty decent job in that sense. And I think that they've also done something interesting with Omer's advantage. He had an idol nullifier that never even made the show. I think for as much as that like limits our information watching the show, I'm kind of okay with it. Like that, like we don't need to be cluttered up with another whole thing if it never ends up mattering. Now, I think it did maybe end up a little bit mattering, but you know, so I don't love that. But like, it, you know, you can add as many advantages as you want. If they don't end up mattering, just don't bother to show them. I think that's fine too, for the most part. So overall, I do like the direction that the show has gone in the last two seasons. I think that they're experimenting with a lot of things. I think a lot of them worked. I think a few of them really did not. And I hope that they ditch the things that didn't and continue with the things that did, personally.
Yeah, I feel like a few of the things also, like, they got lucky with how they worked. And I don't know if necessarily they took the right lessons away from things like Knowledge is Power being good television two seasons in a row, but really only because people let that information out. I do think, you know, something you've talked about a ton in the past, that, you know, they need to like have all the players with the information of what's going on in the game. But I do feel like that they want, for whatever reason, they love like, oh, you're going to be shot. Even like, oh, we're going to read the votes right now. Like, would that have changed anything if the players knew that they were reading the votes on, you know, at the tribal council?
I don't think so. Like, I don't think anybody changes their vote because it's going to be read immediately, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. All good stuff. Taryn, anything else? Final thoughts on Survivor 42?
I think that like the biggest headline we kind of opened with, which is if you're going to take anything away from this season gameplay wise, it's look at Marianne's final tribal performance. It's a class by itself. You know, just watch it. Listen to her talk with Rob when she does to explain her thought process going into it and why she made the choices that she did. Because she seemingly took a situation where she was not going to win and changed it into one where she did win. And I think if we're going to add anything to it, it's that it wasn't just the final tribal performance. You can't just win on that alone. She got to the finish line with the final tribal performance, but it was also the work and the planning and the relationship building that she did prior to that allowed her to work her magic with the final tribal performance. So keep the final tribal performance in mind as you're playing. And that can be a big thing that that you might learn from season 42.
All right. Well, Taryn, great job here on the Survivor Academy. And we'll learn a lot more when we have more of these interviews. And it's feeling like this is going to be a season where we have a lot. I don't know if it's going to be Taryn, Big Brother Canada 10 levels, but I feel like, you know, I've been in contact with a lot of the players and they all seem up for it. So this is a really fun group. I really like this. I don't know if it's been said, but the Survivor 42 cast is really good.
Casting has been great. The editing, I think, has been interesting. Mm-hmm. Good in some areas, bad in other areas. But in terms of like how they've been in the past, I think it's been maybe a little better in at least some areas again. But yeah, the casting, I think, in particular, has been some of the best parts of the recent seasons of Survivor. And I think this cast was very fun.
Okay, Taryn, what's coming up for you?
Big Brother in a few weeks.
Yep, you ready?
Just about a month or so away from the season 24 premiere, which means probably a cast drop about a week before that. You know, leading up to that, just come hang out on Twitch with me, twitch.tv/Taryn Armstrong, playing some games like Among Us and Goose Goose Duck, where you lie to your friends and, you play little mini Survivor games essentially, every week. So, tune in for that. And as I said, I've been making some videos, on those, so you can check those out. Yeah,
what
on
kind
my
of
YouTube
videos?
Channel.
Like you go back and you watch like an old game.
Yes, all the way back to the start. I've just put together some of the more interesting games that we've played with either funny moments or interesting results, or maybe even just like teachable things of just like this was a really effective game from an imposter who was lying or something, or this is how we caught somebody who was lying. Mm-hmm. So they're fun.
Okay, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Taryn, thank you so much for lending your expertise to us here in the Survivor Academy. Greatly appreciated. Of course, we have a ton of Survivor stuff coming your way here. And of course, all of our Big Brother coverage coming as well. And of course, we want to make sure you're subscribed for it all. Thank you for joining us here on the Survivor Academy all season long. This was a lot of fun for me to go through. So thank you for being here, and hope to do more of this in the future. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.